Our guest this month is Tom Guttridge, who's been the Artistic Director of Union House Theatre at Melbourne University since 2008. Previously, he was the Artistic Director of Black Swan Theatre Company in Perth, but his career has taken him to both Queensland and Melbourne theatre companies. He studied at the VCA after completing a Bachelor of Fine Arts at Melbourne University, and recently he's completed a Master of Arts writing a thesis on the training of theatre directors. His credits include main stage opera and theatre direction, sound design and composition, dramaturgy and writing across all live and digital media. And during 2013, he directed both series of the live show Yes, Prime Minister when it toured across Australia. Tom is currently working at the University of Melbourne, where he's focused on building a creative environment which more accurately reflects the demographics of contemporary Australia and which provokes emerging artists to question the sources of their ideas. He's interested in the importance of risk in all its forms, in the development of judgment, confidence and purpose in young people. His theme today is the creation of cultural capital, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what you have to say on that subject. Thank you, Tom.
Thanks, Charles. I'm going to read this presentation in the interests of kind of brevity and clarity, but I might just do a couple of excursions on the way. As the world becomes increasingly homogenous on an economic level, it becomes increasingly fractured on a cultural level. The global brands such as Coke and Apple both contradict and facilitate this fragmentation. You might call it niching of other aspects of the world. So for example, everyone wants an iPod, but the music someone chooses to curate and play on such a device can reflect an individual cultural context that transcends geography and education. A Bengali teenager can fill her iPod with American hip-hop and Bollywood hits, while an American retiree can load up with Bob Dylan and Bengali techno. My son listens to the Sex Pistols and Russian gypsy music and Mozart when he's studying, but there is no obvious cultural homogeneity that can be assumed anymore. That doesn't mean that the drivers of cultural connection have gone away. People still want to connect, to define their group, their locale, their tastes and their differences. So these two contradictory factors, the desire to choose and forge an individual identity and the desire to belong to a group, to feel connected, are at the heart of what I want to talk about and what I believe the role of the arts is in the future. Now, before I start talking specifically about culture and arts, I wanted to indulge myself and make some observations about the broader context in which the arts exist in Australia. As Charles mentioned, I have a particular interest in attitudes to risk and risk management. I really hope that the increase in reporting and box ticking that commonly comes under the heading of compliance has led to a significant decrease in deaths, injuries, psychological harms and economic losses. However, I suspect that these intended outcomes bring with them unexpected and socially damaging impacts. The most disturbing is a growing inability among children and young people who have grown up in this risk-averse environment to judge risk. This leads either to young people leading extremely narrow and constrained lives because they have been trained to avoid anything new and unknown, or conversely, to young people who are oblivious to dangerous situations because they haven't had any experience of them. And I have encountered both these types in my work at the university. An example of the first kind is I directed a play 2 years ago, and there was a cast of seven people, and I discovered quite early on that not one of them had ever climbed a tree. One of them had to play an orangutan, so that was a problem. And an example of the other kind was a young man in one of our theatres who tried to iron his costume while he was wearing it. So I'm going to come back to these socio-cultural impacts later in my talk. But the risk aversion phenomenon also has a significant impact in the arts, particularly the performing arts, where risk is an important element in creating successful and compelling work. Of course, I'm talking mostly about creative risk-taking rather than physical risk-taking, although, of course, circus and physical theatre involve both. But I believe that the two types of risks are strongly related. as anyone who has stepped out in front of an expectant crowd of 2,000 people will attest, it can be just as terrifying as jumping out of an aeroplane. Adrenaline is certainly a factor in both. I also suspect that risk aversion leads to the inadvertent downgrading of expertise in favour of qualification. And that's my take on that is because in practice the key driver for most compliance is the fear of litigation and reputational damage. So the imperative becomes to demonstrate compliance through reporting and documentation. And ironically, that doesn't necessarily mean creating safer or more compliant environments. An example would be a factory supervisor with 30 years' experience on the floor is likely to create a very safe working practice and working environment if they're given the resources. But a factory owner wanting to avoid work cover claims is much more likely to hire an expensive outside consultant with tertiary qualifications and no knowledge of the factory to produce a written report that demonstrates compliance. In the theatre where I mostly work, this has particular ramifications. Every production constitutes an entirely new working environment with new hazards, challenges, environments and dynamics, so compliance has become increasingly expensive and problematic, despite the presence of expert staff. But we find a way. The other factor that affects us all is technology. It's hard to overestimate the impact that technology has had on virtually every aspect of Western society in the last 20 years. Mobile phones have utterly changed our conception of being alone. The internet has transformed our relationship with information. Advances in laser, optical fibre, nanotechnology revolutionised medical treatment. Robotics have changed industry. Computer modelling has changed farming in just about every other field. And social media have created whole new worlds of social interaction, political activation and self-promotion. And as for genetic engineering, 3D printing and wireless power, the impacts of these will probably become clearer over the next few decades. In the arts, technology has already transformed most disciplines, as well as generating new disciplines. So that's my broad take on some of the context in which the arts take place and that affect all of us, including artists. But how have these influences specifically played out in the arts? I'm going to shift back to a kind of a specific context for the arts, which is the assimilation of postmodernism, or the postmodern paradigm. Roland Barthes wrote his essay, The Death of the Author, in 1967, where he shifted the making of meaning from the writer or artist to the reader or audience. The words of the text were now understood as a collection of influences and references sourced from existing culture that would be differently interpreted by each reader each time the text was encountered. The intention of the writer-artist was irrelevant and or suspect. Oddly enough, postmodernism, which is still, I think, considered kind of relatively esoteric in mainstream society, is pretty much everyday fare in popular culture and in cultural production. And it isn't necessarily named, but the key constructs of it, so semiotics, which is the manipulation of signs, the fragmented nature of meaning, and the role of the reader or audience in the act of making meaning, are assimilated in much of pop culture. So an example might be a contemporary pop video, which is almost a textbook example of postmodern techniques. It's kind of full of cultural references. It makes a feature of its artificiality. It's often a pastiche of other artists' material, and it is open to multiple readings. Now, one of the perhaps unexpected paradigm shifts of postmodernism has been a more democratic notion of who can and does make art, as well as who consumes it and how and where they do so. If the reader makes the meaning, then the reader is a creator as much as the writer and can take that role too. This has led to developments on a number of different levels. On the one level, there's been a trend for professional artists to work with the public on creative works that have high-profile outcomes. The community art movement of the 1960s and 70s put the emphasis on the social impacts, but sometimes the actual art making was a bit uninspiring. But these recent community projects have included, I think, some of the most aesthetically and formally interesting works of the last few years. I'm not sure if anyone here saw 100% Melbourne, But it was a really good example of a project of this kind. It was generated by a German group called the Rimini Protocol, and it began with the process of selecting 100 Melburnians who personified the demographics of the city in terms of age, gender, region of birth, and a number of other things. Now, each person selected had to nominate the next person according to the demographic criteria they were provided with, so that only the very first of the 100 people selected was selected by the project organiser. And then the event itself was a cross between a quiz show, a public forum, and a theatre spectacular. On a circular revolving stage, the participants responded to questions about their life views by creating a kind of living pie chart. They would take up the microphone to put their case, they danced, they told stories, they asked the audience questions back. It was encased in high-tech AV projections, lighting and sound were used to provide focus, detail and atmosphere. This is the kind of project that pushes the boundary of form not by taking an elitist position, but by questioning what performance is and how it might interact more openly with more people. And there are a number of Australian performance companies, such as Sydney's Version 1.0, Melbourne's Inotrope, who also work in ways that integrate non-professional performers into sophisticated productions. So on another level, the combination of the democratic impulse with new technologies has de-linked many emerging artists and groups from government funding. It's now perfectly feasible for a young theatre company to put on a performance in a found space with sophisticated sound and lighting operated from a notebook computer. They can promote the show through an entirely free marketing campaign on social media based around a promotional image or e-flyer created on that same notebook computer. The remaining costs, so some props, costumes, a bit of venue hire, perhaps some food and drink for opening night, are relatively small. And this increasingly means that the downsides of applying for a grant, having to frame your idea according to the policy imperatives of the day and then waiting several months to find out if you got lucky, can outweigh the upside of risking the taxpayers' money instead of your own. Some of the more remarkable performances I've seen over the last few years by companies such as Four Larks, Winterfall and the Black Lung Theatre and Whaling Company have been of this type. The capacity for these companies to quickly follow their creative impulses and develop new work, then stage it cheaply but effectively, has seen a flourishing and proliferation of independent theatre in Australia over the last 10 years. There's another angle on this democratising tendency, which is the rise of the YouTube artist. If anyone could be an artist, then someone with a broadband connection, a webcam, and an idiosyncratic idea can find an audience completely unmediated by any of the traditional gatekeepers, such as publishers, TV production companies, or talent scouts. PewDiePie is a Swedish video gamer who has a YouTube channel that has 32 million subscribers. It did when I looked earlier this week. I think it's probably grown since then. His subscribers tune in to watch and listen to PewDiePie playing the latest video game and commenting amusingly on the action. There are also more and more examples of musicians and bands building significant online followings without ever visiting a recording studio or playing live. This kind of grassroots creativity is associated with one of the major problems facing the cultural industries at present, which is piracy. Consumers of online content see no clear reason to pay for one type of content because it's been professionally produced, when they are actively encouraged to download free content, such as PewDiePie, who generates his revenue simply from clicks and advertising. And this is creating distortions of market and opportunity that have no clear solution, as far as I can see, at present. So the major downside of what is largely the positive impact of a more democratic creative sector is the discounting of skill as a factor in being able to make a living. Highly trained composers who have invested huge amounts of time and money in honing their skills are now confronted with technology which allows an amateur sound designer to mix a library of sampled sounds through a pre-programmed algorithm generator to create something that sounds like a Hollywood soundtrack. At present, this doesn't seem to have discouraged people from trying to become professional musicians, but what about in the future? Well, we'll get to that soon. Interestingly, the potency and prevalence of new technologies and their rapid adoption by many areas of cultural production, films, music, publishing, video gaming, has led to another of the significant trends in the sector, but this time as a reaction against technology. In the 1990s, the pessimists predicted that the video store, cable TV and video games would devastate any event which meant that people had to leave their homes. And now while the statistics are yet to show conclusive trend, there is an agreement, I think, in the industry that there is a growing passion for live events. If any of you attended this year's White Night in Melbourne CBD, I think you'll probably be tempted to agree. I've certainly noticed it amongst the students that I work with, that they have a new appetite for live events with all the energy and unpredictability that such events provide. Young people consume live bands, theatre, cross-art form festivals like The Village, the Falls Festival. They go to dance parties, they participate in choirs. They also have a tendency to take up things like knitting and crocheting, I think specifically because they have nothing to do with technology. And it's not just traditional live art forms that are showing this trend. There is also a striking growth in new live art forms. Often these are also infused with that postmodern desire for greater audience involvement and agency. For example, the rise of the durational real word game. I was doing inverted commas there. This is code for adults playing structured games in public. The group Pop-Up Playground has pioneered this work, inventing games that might range from a version of Grandmother's Footsteps to quite complex narrative-based games involving props and requiring players to play out scenarios as they move through the streets. Another manifestation of this trend includes the participatory performances of polyglot theatre, which might combine professional performances and immersive environments where the audience is invited to enter the set and engage with tasks or objects. And of course the phenomenon of the flash mob, the sudden pre-planned action by a number of people in a public, often crowded place. This new type of performance has already evolved from a form of political activism. I think the early flash mobs were nearly always making a point, to sophisticated advertising. If anyone wants to see the apotheosis of the flash mob, Google the opening of the Rembrandt Museum in Ghent. These seismic shifts in the way culture is being produced and consumed have naturally driven some deep thinking about the ways in which government and societies can approach and support the arts and how these new creative directions can be accommodated in a dialogue about culture. You've probably heard of the work of the economist Richard Florida, whose book The Rise of the Creative Class was published in 2002. His thesis connected the attractiveness of urban areas to a creative class of engineers, designers, artists and educators and connected it with economic growth in those areas. His work has fed into quite a lot of subsequent policy making around urban planning and the development of creative industry hubs. It has also had the unintended result of reinforcing an instrumental attitude to arts and culture among politicians and bureaucrats, which has trapped many advocates for investment in culture into linking arts funding with other social benefits and outcomes, and has made it appreciably harder to argue for the intrinsic value of the sector. However, there are a number of thinkers who have successfully addressed this area. The UK thinker John Holden of the Demos Foundation has been a leading figure in providing new frameworks and models. His pamphlet, Democratic Culture, presents access to culture as both a participant and consumer as an important social right. Holden seeks to dismantle the entrenched division between the elite arts, such as opera and ballet, and the amateur or grassroots landscape of garage bands and flower shows. He looks at the assumptions behind ideas such as artistic excellence, to find that many are simply techniques to preserve the influence of various cultural gatekeepers, those with the powers to define what is and is not excellent. Holden asserts that a discourse about quality is important, but should be as accessible as possible rather than couched in terms that exclude people by the use of jargon or insider knowledge. He sees the opening up of culture to a wider audience as an opportunity to enrich the arts by inviting a third voice into a discussion about its value. So in addition to the voices of the establishment and the avant-garde art expert, we should also include the voice of the public, which is often not included at the moment. In order to make a discussion of culture more transparent, he identifies three broad categories of cultural product: publicly funded culture, commercial culture, and handmade culture. The titles are chosen to simply name the source of funding and, by implication, the decision-making mechanisms that apply to each. So publicly funded culture would include Opera Australia and Como House, and government and local councils would be deciding the outcomes of those funding requests. Commercial culture would include a U2 concert and a karaoke club, and it would be in the hands of entrepreneurs and investors. And handmade culture would include online poetry and quilting circles, and there are no barriers to involvement beyond lack of money, time, or accessibility or access. He points out that all three of these categories do have their particular discourses around quality and importance, but he also shows that the three categories are strongly interconnected and there is movement between them. For example, a band might start as a project between friends in someone's garage, handmade, be picked up by the market, sell a lot of CDs and downloads, commercial, before being invited to perform their iconic album at a concert at the Albert Hall, publicly funded. I don't know if anyone knows the West Australian band The Triffids, but they've been through exactly that cycle. So they were a kind of grunge punk band that started in the 1980s, had some commercial success in Europe and the UK, and in 2008 they were invited to play one of their albums at the Sydney Festival in a specific concert. So if we accept Holden's reframing of the discussion about the value of culture, then many more activities are legitimised and many more people are given a voice in the conversation. In Australia, there are a number of voices which are slowly entering the conversation after a long period of exclusion and marginalisation. In our country, an Aboriginal face on a long-running soap opera or an Asian name on the cover of a new Australian novel are still an occasion for comment. Despite the demographic reality of our population, the subset of practising artists still looks pretty much like the 1970s, predominantly Anglo-Saxon, male and living in a capital city. The desire for a cultural scene which more accurately reflects the society it inhabits is not simply to do with fairness. I think it is becoming increasingly clear that there is great creative energy in diversity. This is recognised by the Australia Council for the Arts' new strategic plan for the next 5 years, which puts Indigenous culture in a central position. This is not tokenism, but a response to the instincts and views of many Australians who were interviewed or surveyed in the development of the policy. The consensus is that the next phase of a national cultural conversation will need to have Indigenous culture at its heart. The strategic plan also talks about inclusion more broadly, again reflecting something that is already underway. It's notable that Australia's most admired and critically acclaimed theatre company with an international reputation for innovation is probably Back to Back Theatre. Back to Back is based in Geelong and its ensemble is made up of performers with disabilities. And possibly Australia's most well-known and admired elite artist is Lee Xuan Sing, Mao's last dancer, who is currently the artistic director of the Queensland Ballet. Certainly my experience at the University of Melbourne is that the demographic of people involved in culture there is much more an accurate reflection of the broader population than mainstream arts. And I can see that there is a real need and a real opportunity for those barriers to come down elsewhere, and for I think at the moment Asian students at university who are interested in culture are still resisting moving into the professional art practice because their parents don't like the idea and they're a bit too sensible to kind of take that risk. But it is happening. I've been mentoring a young director, Felix Ho, who's a Chinese national, and she is certainly someone that I think you'll be hearing about in the next few years. Alongside the new strategic plan, The Australia Council has also undertaken a radical overhaul of its funding model, shrinking more than 100 grant categories down to 5 and increasing opportunities to apply for them from once a year to 4 times a year. So applications will no longer be assessed within specific art form areas either, such as dance, literature, music and theatre, but each application will be assessed by a mix of art form experts depending on the nature of the proposed project. These changes have been driven by the trends that I've already mentioned, such as the increasing tempo of cultural production and the emergence of new arts practices. However, the advantages of this more flexible and responsive model must be balanced against the potential dangers of the overall policy shift, which frames government support principally as seed funding. The way this seems to play out in practice is a growing gap between established artists and companies who continue to receive funding because they have access and influence with funding bodies and politicians, and emerging artists who increasingly see themselves as outsiders, unlikely to succeed with a funding application and so less motivated to try. And while in the short term this may not be a problem, young artists are trading on their energy and enthusiasm and they're generating art without government support, but I think there is the likelihood that at some point in the next 2 decades, the lack of economic security will see a much higher attrition rate amongst that generation. So I've probably arrived at the point where I move beyond observation of current trends to predictions about where things will be in 10 or 20 years. With the funding environment going through the most radical change since government arts funding began in the 60s, and the convulsions in economic models that have underpinned artists' incomes for the last 100 years, for example, copyright and music licensing, I would suggest that in 20 years' time, a very different set of artists will be making a living than the ones that do so now. The fragmenting of genres and disciplines is likely to continue based on the reach of digital technology, which allows arcane and idiosyncratic interests to band together to form, at a global level, a sustainable niche market. We may, in this way, see another golden age of poetry, with star poets reaching fans across the world. Music, literature and other forms that lend themselves well to recording and distribution will have the opportunity to flourish in this way. At the same time, the trend that I've indicated towards the democratisation of art practice, I think, will continue. The paradigm of the audience as artist is well established and will manifest itself in 2 contrasting ways. Firstly, in the world of technology, as tools for the manipulation and recreation of pre-existing content become more sophisticated, untrained makers will populate a digital space with their own content, swapping and comparing, forming communities of interest, sharing skills and techniques. And then at the opposite extreme, the reaction against digital media, against the dislocating and alienating effects of social media and our virtual lives, there will be a boom in handmade cultural creation. Craft circles, market gardeners, local choirs, yarn bombers, heard you mentioning that, those people who knit sleeves for trees and signposts, living room theatre groups and folk dancers will provide a level of creative satisfaction to more and more people as they seek the satisfaction of human connection and interaction. And what will be the art form of the 21st century, the equivalent of film in the 20th century? Well, my money is on what is currently known as the video game. I'm not sure how it will evolve, as I'm sure those pioneers of the motion picture had no idea where those silent images of speeding trains would lead. But there is, I suspect, an entirely new set of aesthetic rhythms and structures latent in Grand Theft Auto and Red Dead Redemption. In 20 years, I suspect some Tarkovsky of the new form will find out the full power of those endlessly bifurcating storylines, the emotional charge of that moment when the gamer must choose, the temporal and narrative delight contained in connecting disparate elements, and, of course, a way to do all this while retaining the pivotal role of the audience participant in the art form itself. The intriguing thing is that once the form is mastered, the actual platform through which it is delivered could be remote from the current setup of a console, a game controller, and a TV screen. Players might experience the work as a gloves and goggles virtual reality, or they might physically enter an immersive environment with mapped projections on moving surfaces and holographic figures, creating an endlessly malleable gamescape, or they may play out the game scenario in a real-life environment without any technology beyond a set of pre-agreed rules and scenarios prompted by objects or instructions found along the way. So when I think about what role the arts will play in Australia's future, and when I say the arts, I include the widest range of mainstream movies, TV, packaged pop music, cosplay, which is people dressing up as cartoon characters, origami, cake making, and boot scooting. I think of two attributes that seem to me to be increasingly important. If, as I hope, the trend for culture to become more democratic and accessible continues, then the arts can become a model for non-economic value in society. John Holden says this about the way the arts work. They are not the same thing as entertainment, and they take us beyond everyday life. Art's role as a substitute for religion, its important social function in critiquing the status quo, and its constant quest to explore new territory and to provide wonder, all militate in favour of seeing the arts as being a step away from mundane, diurnal experience. The arts have always provided elements of this to those who have been lucky enough to grow up with them as part of their lives. I see the trend towards greater participation in and access to and ownership of art and culture as being of great value in creating a more confident, tolerant and thoughtful society. The second role that I see the arts taking on in the future is as an antidote to the risk aversion that pervades society. As I mentioned earlier, risk is built into both creating and responding to art. There is inherent risk in the goal of creating something entirely new each time you paint a picture, write a story, or compose a song. If that risk is avoided, then it's likely that the work will feel derivative or unengaging. Good art, on the other hand, introduces us to adrenaline as a positive thing. Getting up in a choir and singing well, or listening to that choir achieving something unexpected, lets us understand that taking a risk is both life-affirming and confidence-building. For this reason, I relish the democratisation of culture, even if I am unsure exactly how it will impact on professional artists. As more people are introduced to the positive risk-taking involved in making and engaging with art, fewer people are likely to retain an entirely negative view of risk. Learning to take artistic risks can serve, I believe, as a counter to the factors that discourage us in everyday life from trying something new, from stepping outside our comfort zone, and from questioning those in authority. It's by doing those things that we learn to exercise individual judgment and take greater control of our lives. The marvellous thing about participation in the arts is that you can do this in collaboration with other people. Which brings me back to my starting point. We're all driven both to seek community and connection, and to signal our individuality and difference. In engaging with culture, people can be offered a way to do both simultaneously, and that may be the most powerful role that the arts can play of all.